Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ellen April, who's a professor of tax law at Loyola Law School and a fellow of the American College of Tax Counsel and the American Law Institute. She served for 2 years in the Office of Tax Policy in the Department of the Treasury and is a former chair of the Los Angeles County Bar Tax Section and a former vice chair and council director of the American Bar Association's Section on Taxation. And also joining us is Brian Galley, a professor of tax law at Boston College of Law. He's also a visiting professor at Georgetown University's Law Center and George Washington University's Law School and a fellow at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. His primary research interests include taxation, nonprofit organizations, behavioral law and economics, federalism, and public finance economics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ellen April.
Thank you.
And we're still trying to get Brian on, who I spoke to earlier, but for some reason or other, his phone number is not working. So hopefully he will join us. But is this really a storm in a teacup? I mean, the two issues that the president dealt with today in his press conference, standing next to the British Prime Minister, about whom nobody was asking questions. The focus of the press were on the Benghazi story, which the president tried to slap down once again, and this furor over the IRS flagging the word patriot and tax and Tea Party in looking into their 501c4 tax exempt applications. How did the president do, to your mind, in saying that he was outraged and was going to look into it?
As a political matter, I'm not sure that he had much choice but to say that he was outraged. However, I wish he had given at least some credit to the civil servants at the IRS who were trying to do their job, albeit it seems with perhaps a tin ear for the political implications of the way they behaved.
And by that, I take it there are two aspects of this in terms of defending the IRS, which, of course, nobody much wants to do. It's not the world's most popular agency. But my understanding is that since the Citizens United decision, there have been this flood of 501c4 applications which is ostensibly for social welfare activities, but they have been used for political purposes starting in 2010, but really exploding in 2012 with groups like Karl Rove's Crossroads GPS, etc. And my understanding is that the IRS has simply been flooded with these applications, and they were looking for ways to sort of see who was for real and who was a front group.
So they really were trying to triage the issue. 501c4 organizations can engage in some campaign intervention activity, but it cannot be their primary activity. So the question is, how do you decide which organizations seeking exemption as social welfare organizations are going to be engaging in the proper amount of campaign intervention? And the IRS tried to do a shortcut, and whoever picked those search terms didn't stop to think that they really needed to do it on a nonpartisan basis and see if there were other ways of getting at the groups who should not be granted exemption.
But Ellen April, how do you do it on a nonpartisan basis? I was going to say, my understanding is that 99% of applications for 501c4s have come from basically from the Republican side.
I am not aware of that particular number, and so I can't speak to that, but there certainly have been some on the left side as well. And ultimately, by May 2012, the IRS changed their criteria to organizations with indicators of significant amounts of political campaign intervention. So they didn't look just for words that would tend to show right-side organizations.
So they realized they basically were following the money, as the famous Watergate adage goes.
Yes, that is true. Although these are applications for exemption, it's what they predict they are going to do. It isn't necessarily what they end up doing.
Well, is it true that a lot of these instruments that were used to, and the reason that the 501c4 was attractive to political donors is that it maintained their anonymity, that you didn't have to reveal who was giving you the money. And that, of course, has a certain political appeal to wealthy people who don't want to be identified, and indeed corporations, whose customers might well be Democrats and half of them might be Republicans, and they don't want to be associated with it. So it's become a very popular vehicle.
Become a popular vehicle exactly for the reason you say, that you are not required to publicly disclose the donors. The organization has to tell the IRS who their donors of 5,000 or more are, but the public does not get to see that schedule.
Well, let me bring in Brian Galley, who's a professor of tax law at Boston College of Law. He's also a visiting professor at Georgetown University's Law Center and George Washington University Law School, and a fellow at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. His primary research interests include taxation, nonprofit organizations, behavioral law and economics, federalism, and public finance economies. Welcome to Background Briefing, Brian Galley.
Hi, Ian. Thank you very much.
And let's begin with the timeline here of when the IRS, and my understanding is it was a mid-level people in the IRS's office in Cincinnati who originally started flagging the tax exempt applications for groups using the word Tea Party or Patriot. And what is causing this furor, particularly on Fox News, who apparently got a hold of a document, is that the activity was more extensive than what Commissioner Douglas Shulman first reported to the Congress.
That's what's been reported?
Yeah, that, in other words, the furor is about now is that the activity itself was more extensive than what was first reported to the Congress by Commissioner Douglas Shulman. So is that what's happening?
Well, of course, I don't know what happened at the IRS office specifically, but I do know that in some ways it seems, at least to some people who follow these issues closely, like a tempest in a teapot, because it's rather routine for organizations that are planning on doing activities that walk very close to the line of what's permissible for a charitable organization to do to receive extra questioning about what they're planning on doing. If you're doing something that might be illegal, I think it's natural for the government to ask you more details about your activity.
Well, let me ask Ellen April, is this why this scandal has legs or is becoming a scandal? Is because there is a contradiction here between what was originally said about low-level employees which was first reported to Congress by Commissioner Douglas Shulman? I mean, in other words, is there a cover-up here?
That's part of the controversy. We really do not know what Commissioner Shulman knew at the time that he gave his testimony. But part of what has happened is that it's easy to hate the IRS, and Lois Lerner's apology came as a surprise to everyone. I was there at the ABA tax section meeting when someone asked her a question from the audience, and she launched into a rather lengthy and detailed discussion and apology that none of us was expecting. We didn't know at the time that the Treasury Inspector General is about to issue a report on what happened with these 501c4 organizations.
So it's basically Lois Lerner who's fueled this controversy, albeit perhaps unwittingly.
I don't know
why she answered in such detail, but the report from the Treasury Inspector General is going to come out at some time. We don't know exactly when, and it would have fueled the controversy then if it had not come out earlier.
And Douglas, Brian?
If I may just add that there's a very common pattern of activity by folks who are heavily regulated and don't like being heavily regulated, and what that activity consists of is trying to embarrass their regulators. And they try to embarrass their regulators at any opportunity, even in opportunities that are relatively innocuous, but that the public doesn't understand are innocuous. And to me, at least, that seems what this story is about. And there may have been some, I have no idea what folks at the IRS knew at a particular time. There may have been some internal miscommunications. But I think if you read what Lois Lerner has said in public, essentially, it seems like what she said are things that, again, to those of us who follow these issues, seem sensible. She was saying that they directed their field office to focus on the things that the law appropriately requires the IRS to examine, but not to do that in a way that would leverage political power against any particular group. But if you have a group that has, in published reports, done things that are clearly questionable under existing law, I think it's sensible to ask more detailed questions about those groups.
And let me pick up on what Brian says. These organizations chose to apply for exemption. And if they choose to apply for recognition of exemption, that meant they knew they were going to get questions from the IRS. And it's very common to have an application followed with quite detailed questions, although some of these organizations did get somewhat unusual questions. Brian and I disagree about just how unusual.
I think that's fair. But I think what's common in the past is any time a group has been subject to close scrutiny for their political activities and the president who is in office happens to be of a party that isn't theirs, to complain about political bias. And this happened 5 years ago when it was George Bush who was president and there were black churches around the country that were politically active. And I don't know that their complaints of political bias were any more or less meritorious than the ones we're hearing about now, but it's just a very common tactic for an advocate to use when the opportunity is there, if the president is of the other party, as a way of deflecting or diminishing the scrutiny that you're getting, or exploiting it if your goal is to embarrass the president.
Well, but isn't this a new instrument we're talking about, a relatively new instrument, the 501c4, supposedly for social welfare? It's been obviously used to disguise major donors, and that's why it's attractive. Karl Rove started out with Crossroads, and then he realized that he also formed a 501c4, Crossroads GPS, and that's where most of his money went, or the money that he raised went. And my understanding is that just the application for a 501c4 is sufficient for you to receive the money. And so, in other words, the vehicle is way ahead of the IRS. They're always playing catch up. Is that not true?
Brian, you want to take this one?
Yeah, sure. I think that is true to a significant extent, that the involvement of C4s in political campaigns seems to be new from the best that we can tell from publicly available information.
And let me follow up on that a little bit. The rules that they are relying on are not new. These particular rules that allow them to do some campaign intervention but not as their primary activity go back to 1959. And, for example, the Sierra Club is a 501c4 in order to be able to do a great deal of lobbying and some campaign intervention. But we haven't seen the numbers or the level or the dollars that we have been seeing since Citizens United for 501c4s.
And isn't that the point here, though, that you have these two conflicting forces at work? You have this vast influx of money coming in through these vehicles that provide anonymity to the donors on the one hand, and on the other hand, you have this constant attrition of the IRS where the Congress keeps cutting their budget and they have fewer and fewer people to look at these applications.
The Congress keeps cutting their budget and holding hearings into whether or not they're overly politicizing their enforcement processes.
And Ellen, am I correct in suggesting that we have two opposing forces at work here? This flood of applications on the one hand, and the IRS itself not having the manpower to deal with them.
And in addition, within the IRS, there's the issue of how they best use their money. Since the regulators of tax-exempt organizations, their audits and their activities are not going to produce revenue for the government the way that audits of rich taxpayers and corporations will do. So there's always a pressure in terms of how much the resources of the IRS go to the exempt org division of the IRS.
Well, isn't it true that the IRS does spend most of its efforts going after ordinary middle-class taxpayers who have fairly modest incomes compared to the more vastly wealthy people? I mean, I read a report recently to that effect. Is there a disparity there?
I don't know. Brian, do you?
I don't have those statistics at my fingertips, but the IRS has always been upfront that they try to emphasize sources of greater revenue, but there are so many more middle-class people than there are very wealthy people. It wouldn't surprise me to hear that there are, in total, more audits of people who are in the middle class, but I would guess that per capita, probably people with very high incomes are probably audited more often.
And the total percentages for everyone is still very small for audits.
Yeah, less than 2%.
Right. Well, but I guess my question is based upon, again, going back to the old Watergate adage, follow the money. You'd think that the focus would be on those who have money as opposed to those who don't and that have the ability to shield that money or shelter it, as they say.
The IRS has certain criteria it uses when they think it's more likely for them to find taxes that haven't been paid, and we don't know all the details of what those are.
So, sorry to get slightly off the topic here, but as both of you know, this is the beginning of a political firestorm, and that I think it's fair to say that we'll hear more and more about this, and there'll be hearings, will there not, Ellen?
Yes, there will be hearings.
And Brian, do you expect this story has legs? Brian?
I think that the incentives of the people involved are to make it have legs, and they have opportunities with sympathetic media outlets to make sure that that happens, at least at those outlets, yes.
So just to both of you, since you're in the real world and not in the political world, what would you, Brian, wish that the American people were told about what you know about this, as opposed to the kind of political circus that we're going to go through in the next weeks and months?
Well, I think I'd like them to know that IRS examination of organizations for excessive political activities isn't rare, and that's as it should be, because, at least in my view, it's appropriate to separate charity from pure partisan activity, because the taxpayer dollars that go to support charity are meant to support charity and not meant to support efforts to elect your favorite candidate or mine.
And Ellen, what would you, in a perfect world, like the public to know about this burgeoning scandal?
And that, I do not think it was politically motivated. I do not think it came from high up. I think they were civil servants trying to do their job in the most efficient way and didn't think about some of the consequences of the terms they chose in order to try to do their work as efficiently as possible.
And you were at this meeting at which the IRS official, Lois Lerner, essentially broke this story.
Yes, I was.
So tell us about that context there, because obviously this is you were there. You may not have known at the time, but you were there when the tempest burst forth from the teapot.
So Lois had already given her remarks. She gave her update. She asked four questions from the audience.
And where were the audience, by the way?
This was the exempt organization committee of the ABA tax section.
And the American Bar Association.
Right, and she, Lois Lerner, is the Irish official in charge of tax-exempt charities, is she not?
exempt organizations, which are more than just charities. Yes.
Right. Okay. So continue. I don't mean to interrupt you.
No. So she was answering questions, and then one of the exempt organization lawyers asked her something about C4s and Tea Parties. I cannot remember the exact question that this person asked someone I know. And Lois started in with this detailed of what had happened and said an apology that we hadn't done it right and it took us a while to get it right. And nobody was expecting that. It was an extraordinarily detailed and surprising answer to the question. I have talked to the person who asked her the question. Some people thought it was a setup, but the person who asked the question assures me that it wasn't, and the person who asked the question is someone I've known for years and I would trust with my life.
So, Brian, then, my understanding is that a lot of the anti-government, you know, not paying your taxes, hate the IRS, all of that stuff that we've heard of forever, and people who refuse to pay their taxes, most of that stuff happens on the political right and with militia groups and Tea Party groups who are very openly anti-government, and they see the government as being evil. And I don't think that's unfair, and I just don't understand why you would have a government agency that wasn't alert to this kind of political, you know. Ellen was saying it's they have a political tin ear, but it would seem to me pretty obvious that the people who are most against the IRS and are likely to take these kind of anti-government stands are fairly identifiable. They're the ones who say it in the first place. So, I mean, obviously, I'm not advocating that the kind of intrusion that that this indicates into people's lives and politics. But just in the last minute, is there any should we be surprised?
I don't think we should be surprised, and I don't think it's intrusive. As Ellen said before, when you're seeking special tax benefits that no one else gets, you should expect to have to answer the questions that establish that you're entitled to them. And particularly if you're disclosing that your plan is to change the Constitution and to elect conservative politicians, and the tax laws say that those kinds of activities aren't entitled to special tax benefits, you should expect that you're going to get some extra questions. And we should also expect that those kinds of people are going to use the opportunity of an inartfully worded way of emphasizing a search for groups that aren't eligible to embarrass the government, which is consistent with their political preferences.
Well, I thank both of you for joining us here today, Ellen April and Brian Galley.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Ellen April, who's a professor of tax law at Loyola Law School and a fellow of the American College of Tax Counsel and the American Law Institute. And also joining us is Brian Galley, professor of tax law at Boston College and also a fellow at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Nick Garino. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.